Today's podcast is sponsored by MPB, the online pricing engine that provides the right price for any camera or lens. Get free kit pickup and get paid within days, all without leaving your home. How much could you get? Find out with a free instant quote at www.mpb.com/sell.
Hello and welcome to the AVFORMS podcast for Monday the 10th of July. My God, it's the seventh month of the year already. And joining me tonight, we've got Doug Piper, Ian Collin and Ed Selly. Good evening, guys.
Good evening, Phil.
Right, busy show tonight. We've got lots to get through, lots of TV stuff to talk about, lots of home cinema kit to talk about, and we've got some hi-fi as well. And of course, we've also got Ed doing his hi-fi and Ian doing the news, and of course we've got lots to talk about, including Panasonic. So I told you last time we were live that I was going down to Bracknell to have a look at the 2023 range. I've done that. There is a video on our YouTube channel. Go and watch that after you've watched this podcast. We are live on YouTube at the moment, so if you want to leave your comments, the comments chat window is open. You can do that. We're also going to go through some questions from the last time we were out on the podcast, some of the questions that were added to the thread, which of course you can do if you're listening a little bit later in the week to the recorded version of this podcast. Leave us a question in the podcast forum at AV Forums underneath this podcast, and we will come back the following podcast and we shall answer those. As long as we know the answers, we'll answer those. So yeah, Panasonic tonight. I'm also going to talk about TVs that are in for review. I'm moving from OLED to mini LED now, so I've got a few mini LED models in. We'll talk about that. Doug's been looking at Perlistan R-Series home cinema speakers and also the Marantz's Cinema 60 AVR. Marantz currently celebrating their 70th birthday as well. So yeah, we'll talk about that. Ed, we'll be reviewing the Mission 778X. We've also got our usual news from Ian. And of course, if you ask any questions tonight, we'll do them live as soon as they pop up in the chat window. And as long as we've got time to do that. So the chat window is open. Or of course, if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, you can send us an email. It's podcast@avforums.com for that. You can do that at any point and we will pick them up and we'll answer your questions should that happen. Now, normally I'd go to the feedback from previous podcasts. I'm not going to do that just yet because I've just had a look and they're all TV questions. So we'll move that to the TV section and we'll answer those when we can. So before we get started, let's find out what everybody's doing. Now, Doug, you haven't been around for a little while, so what have you been up to?
Yeah, I've been busy with a flooded house. There was a freak flash flood that took out the ground floor of my house. So, I mean, fortunately, it's a place we've just bought and we're kind of gradually moving into. So I'm not actually living there at the minute, but that's kept me busy and that's why I haven't been around in the evening so much. But most recently, the most interesting thing I did was went to Glastonbury, which was great. Got to see Elton's last UK tour date, which was absolutely fantastic. I think it might be one of the best headliner slots.
So did you do the full weekend, Doug?
Yeah, I always do it. I go pretty much every year.
Somehow
managed to get tickets every year. Touchwood.
Yeah. I don't know how people manage to get tickets. I've tried and tried and tried.
Spreadsheets, and a system.
Right.
That's how me and my friends do it. We've got very, very sort of detailed system. it works. It works. And we seemingly get in every year. But yeah, Elton's headline slot was absolutely phenomenal. And like I say, I go every year, and I can't think of a headliner who had a set that was so free of any duds or any songs that people aren't familiar with. It was just hit after hit after hit, and the whole crowd was singing the whole way through. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Excellent.
Nice. Good stuff. Doug, I have to ask the doom-mongery question. When you say a freak flash flood, have you spoken to any of your new neighbours about, has it happened before?
No, it's never happened. Yeah, no. I've seen all the reports and what have you. It was I don't want to bore you with the detail, but there was a bank of cloud that stayed freakishly long over the nearby fields, and it was just roll off from the fields. They couldn't absorb it, and it's never happened in the history of the area.
Are they now regarding you as some sort of portent of doom? This man turns up. Funnily enough, wrong.
Before I bought the place, I want, because it's Somerset and there are floods around there, I thought I'd double check. And one of my best mates, a flood risk assessor at the Environment Agency, and asked him to do a check these topographical maps and check on the place and what have you. And he did all that. And he said, this is the sort of place that we expect to flood by a once in 1,000 year rainfall event.
Excellent.
And within 6 months.
You've had that one, yeah.
I've nailed that. So I've got 1,000 years to wait.
Bold words.
Very unfortunate. But luckily, you didn't have anything too valuable in there that got damaged. No, good. It's good to hear. Ed, what have you been up to?
I've had a relatively quiet phase since the last podcast, if I'm honest. I essentially have been beavering away at things. I finally got some reviews uploaded. There's a review I'm going to talk about this evening. The Mission Amplifier is actually, that's to be written. I started writing it today. I'll finish writing it tomorrow. It was going up it shortly. It's an exclusive, so it didn't turn up until quite recently. Otherwise, I've just been entertaining myself in my usual sordid ways. And yeah, I mean, yesterday I was quite hungover. I won't go into details of that. But I found myself looking at an aged Maserati and thinking, that's actually quite cool. And I mustn't have been in a particularly sound state of mind for me to be thinking that. So yeah, I mean, it's just the same old, really. I might buy another pair of shoes. So yeah, I mean, that's unheralded, I know. Although it has been some period since I bought another set. So yeah, you know. I mean, I've had to deal with car insurance and things like that. I don't know. Everyone's car insurance has gone bananas.
Yes, but mine's doubled. We've got a multi-car policy and it doubled. And it just so happened that I was swapping the car to the Mustang at the time and got on the phone to them and changed the car and did some wheeler dealer and managed to get a really good price, but it had doubled. And everywhere else I tried, it was more expensive than who I was with.
Yeah. All right. Oh, well, I see that. Okay. If we're going to do a competition on this, I am a 42-year-old man. I have held a driving license for over 20 years. No points, no endorsements ever, let alone the last 3 years. Yeah. And I live in Buckinghamshire. How much, and I don't want to single them out on this, but there was a particularly memorable quote. How much did Tesco's want to insure?
Well, about $3,500.
Not quite as bad as that. A mere 1750. I mean, it does appear that I was speaking to someone and it would appear that it's not me perceived as a risk. It's because people enjoy using my car as a means of, you know, moving away from an armed robbery in style and comfort. But yeah, it's pretty brutal out there.
Yeah, but I got told I had to go to specialists because it's a left-hand drive, the new Mustang. You have to go to specialist insure them. So I went to all these specialists, all the ones that were highly recommended. None of them would touch me. They said, no, can't insure you. You've never driven a left-hand drive car in the UK before of that power. We're not going to cover you. And then I did a go compare, and the cheapest one was 1,600 quid. I then had a specialist who came back and said, oh, we'll give you a policy for, but your excess is 1,000. And we want 650 quid off you for the year. And you don't get any other benefits. I'm like, no. And then the last thing was I phoned my current insurer and said, oh, we need to renew and I also want to put this car on. And it was Ford Insurer, Pattern Admiral. And they did it for 80 quid more than what I was paying.
Nice.
For the Puma. And that was imported vehicle, left-hand drive and so on. So yeah, at one point it was like, oh, well, I'm not getting a Mustang because I'm not paying 1,600 quid a year to insure the thing if it's just going to sit and just be used for car club and stuff. But there you go.
Yeah.
Right, talking about car club, been back there. So yeah, back in a Mustang, back doing Mustang things. Currently really enjoying that, really enjoying it because, you know, when you do your hobby for your job and you're doing it as much as I am at the minute because it's TV season, it's nice to get out and do something completely different. So if I'm not at the Mustang club, which we're at the diner, the OK Diner on Tuesday night there, I got a few things coming up. Going to do one at Whitby Abbey in 2 weeks' time, American car thing. So lots of that going on. But I'm also running at the minute, still running. Have you noticed that I'm losing the weight?
No, you're very slight. Oh, I mean, you went so quickly there that I wasn't able to say. So it's going to be a some enormous drafty relics and Whitby Abbey in one place.
Boom, boom, so, test you here all week. Don't try the veal, it's off. Yeah, absolutely. So doing quite a bit of running. In fact, I did 5K on Saturday, and then that wasn't enough, so I went out and did 4 miles on Sunday. So, yeah, kind of getting into that at the minute.
Impressive.
And I'm doing my first ever run event on Friday night, Durham City Run, 5K. I've got a bib number. You get a medal if you finish. So, yeah, first time ever in my life that I'm doing a proper run event. So, yeah, that's what I'm up to at the minute. And finally, we need to see if Ian's left the house.
In virtual terms. I mean, I've been doing lots of running, and I've been driving lots of very nice cars. But unfortunately for my health, they were all in Cyberpunk 2077. which if you don't know, it was a huge video game, came out like 3 years ago. It could probably came close to being one of the biggest games of its generation, both in terms of scope and ambition. But it was a bit buggy when it first came out.
It was an absolute horror show, I thought.
It was like horrible. So I was always kind of putting it off, saying I'll wait until they patch it and fix it. And then I put it off, and then I put it off and kind of forgot about it. But then at the recent Xbox showcase, they highlighted the DLC coming out, I think, in August. And about the same time, it popped up on the Xbox store for, like, I think it was about £17. So it's like, oh, why not? So, I bought that. I've been playing it. And, yeah, it's good. It is good. I mean, it's still buggy in places, and it's still not as amazing as I thought it was going to be when I saw the first teaser trailer, like, I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever, when they first teased what new gen games could look like, and they brought out this amazing CGI trailer for it. Doesn't quite live up to that, but yeah, I'm enjoying it, and getting in my miles, but in a virtual sense.
Can you jet wash in it?
Sadly not. I'm waiting for that crossover. As soon as it comes, they can just take all the money DLC. In the world. I'll give them whatever they like.
Excellent. So that's what the team's been up to since the last podcast. Current competitions are stuff to win. Ed, why don't you tell us what we can go and win?
All right. Give me just a moment. My computer's playing silly buggers at the moment. Right. Okay. There are some decent competitions at the moment. You can win. Here we go. You can win a Humax A1 4K Ultra HD streaming box and 3 Humax Wi-Fi smart plugs as a bundle. You can also win the Spears & Munsell 2023 Ultra HD benchmark disc plus an LX1 bias lighting strip, both courtesy of Scenic Lab. 3 bundles to win on that one. And as a reminder, if you are listening to us in exciting corners of the world, Ulaanbaatar, Timbuktu, this is open to you. You can get entering on this because this prize is available worldwide. So, yeah, you know, now is your time. Get stuck in. There are some exclusive offers for patrons, including something ending on the Wednesday, 12th of July. So if you're listening to it after this point, you'll have to ignore this one. It's David Lynch's Inland Empire on Blu-ray, ending on the Thursday. So if you're listening to this after that point, tough. The Transformers 6 movie 4K UHD Steelbook Collection. My word, imagine watching
what
that.
What have you done to deserve winning that?
It will be spectacular.
Yeah, it'll be spectacular, but yeah. My God.
And then you can also win Le Mepris on 4K UHD, Lola on Blu-ray, The Laureate on Blu-ray, and Scream 6 on Blu-ray. Head on over to avforums.com/competitions to enter. All competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members or patrons resident in the UK, except the Spears & Munsell's competition, which you can go at from wherever you are in the world. Yep. There are no previous winners at this point for me to tell you about.
Excellent. We've got a new patron, Featherhall, has signed up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really is appreciated. Thank you for all your support, all of our patrons who do support the podcast and all the other things that we do on AV Forums. Thank you very much. It is appreciated. Right, okay, let's get on with the show. So we're going to talk TV, and lots of TVs in for review at the minute. So I've covered most of the OLEDs, major OLEDs. The reviews are up there. I'm now moving over to mini LED TVs, and there's quite a number coming out this year. It's still a popular technology, especially if you live in a bright environment and you like to game and you're a little bit concerned about image retention and that kind of thing. Then they are still a popular choice. And of course, it's a market that's dominated by Samsung, Hisense, and TCL. And that's the 3 manufacturers who I have in at the moment. So I've got 2 TCLs. I've got the C 845 65 inch, which will be behind me very soon for testing. I've also got the TCL 55 inch C745. So that's both of the big TVs from TCL this year. Those reviews coming up very soon. I've also got Hisense's new U7K 65 inch. That's the one that's sitting behind me now. So that's literally just landed on the stand today. I'm starting that review this week. So those are reviews that are coming up. One review I am working on, which should be published this week, is the Samsung QN95C, so their flagship 4K TV. They don't count OLED as their flagship. They still go with QLED as their flagship TV. So just a few headline things. The review will drop this week, but just to give you a preview, 1,745 nits. Of peak brightness on an industry standard 10% window, and that does measure correctly. I did try it on an 8%, 9%, 12% windows. It's not doing anything clever there. It's actually doing it correctly. This is also in filmmaker mode, so that's the most accurate mode out of the box in terms of watching things as they were mastered and intended to be seen. So very impressive peak nit brightness, but I'll come back to why it's not that great. 602 nits full screen. HDR color gamut is not quite tracking P3 saturation correctly. It's a little bit off. And P3 coverage is 93% XY, 95% UV, so not the entire DCI P3 color gamut either, which for a Quantum Dot TV is a little bit surprising. But again, we're talking about most accurate picture modes. You can put it in other modes and get 100% measurements, but none of the saturation points at 25, 50, 75 actually line up to where they should be, so completely inaccurate in those modes, which is why we always measure in the most accurate modes, because you're getting things correct. Out of the box, filmmaker mode was accurate. It's great to see filmmaker mode making a big difference for those of you out there who perhaps don't want to get your TV calibrated straight away, or maybe can't afford to get calibrated straight away. The CIE, the color gamut Rec 709, measured really quite well as well. There was a slight magenta hue push, but nothing particularly serious there. That's because the white point was slightly towards yellow, so it kind of just drags everything a little bit across towards yellow. But again, it's not something that you would actually see, because delta E's were all under three, which is the visible threshold. Anything under that, you're not going to see it. You're not going to see color tint or anything like that. So in terms of picture accuracy, very good. Now, I'm going to come back to the peak brightness, why I said it wasn't quite as good as you initially think. And that's because we're talking about a mini LED TV. And one of the things here is the local dimming algorithm and how it displays a very bright object like behind on the screen here, how you have something really bright against a black background. What does happen if you try and push full brightness onto the screen and try and hit that 1745 nits, the blackness is no longer black because you have what's called halo around the object. And what Samsung tried to do with their local dimming algorithm, it's one of the best algorithms out there. They've been working on it a long time, use a lot of supercomputers to, you know, fine-tune this, but it can't do it perfectly. And what it has to do is what's called blooming suppression. So anything that's smaller than kind of 10% in terms of screen area that is taken up by this bright color or brightness, it has to dim it down to stop the blooming. So because it's suppressing the blooming, it's also taking your dynamic range and compressing it, which you can really notice, especially when you got it next to their flagship OLED TV, the S95C. The difference in dynamic range is pretty stark to see to the eye. Now, if you put it in a bright room, which it's designed to be used in, so a room like I'm in at the minute with lots of lights on and so on, then you know the picture does stand up well. You don't really notice the blooming suppression too much. It is still restricting the dynamic range, but it's not massively noticeable. But when you're side by side and you're looking for that dim room movie experience, that compressed dynamic range, even though it's hitting 1745 nits in a measured environment on a 10% window, you're not getting that real life because of the blooming suppression. And that's just one of the downsides. And when you have the two screens next to each other, things like highlights that are round, there's a scene that I use on Spears of Man, so you've probably seen it behind me here while I've been talking, of the honey spoon with honey falling off it, and you get the light glistening. On the OLED, it's It's realistic. It's all there. On the mini LED, it's not as, it hasn't got as much pop. It doesn't look quite as real because it's having to dim that brightness down, so you don't get this halo that's also around the object. So one of the downsides of the technology there. Otherwise, gaming wise, absolutely brilliant. Really fast screen. It's got the the gaming bar on there. Does most of the VRR standards out there. Again, mini LED, so it does push the brightness. It clips properly for gaming as well, so you're not going to get any blown out highlights if you set it up correctly with your consoles or so on. So yeah, as a gaming TV, it's absolutely spot on there. Other things, upscaling is particularly good, although it does look a little bit processed. So if you're used to a Sony image, which is a little bit processed, it's just a little bit more than that. So a little bit more edge enhancement there, but you want particularly. But yeah, good TV. Full review is coming. And that just gives you a bit of a taster for that one. And like I say, lots more mini LED TVs coming up and FALD TVs as well lined up for review. At the moment, it is TV season, so expect lots more TV reviews to come through. Lots more videos that I'm working on as well. So I've got a few of those. And I've still got projectors that have sadly ended up on the sidelines at the minute. Those reviews coming as well. So lots of things going on at the moment there. Any questions at this moment in time on anything that we've mentioned here? So Michael H says, do QD OLEDs or MLA avoid pink blue tinted patches that you get on white grey with LG OLEDs? Having a nightmare with carriers having to deal with a C7. C7's quite an old panel now, and you had similar with a 42-inch C2, which was last year's TV. So yeah, the old, last year, I'm saying old, it was only last year, OLED EX panels, they do, if you get off to one side, particularly, there is a bit of a pink tinge. I did mention that in the reviews. You have to be sitting off axes, though, to really see them, unless you get a really bad panel in terms of uniformity. QD OLED's a little bit better. You don't see as much. And MLA is very, very good. I didn't see any issues with MLA this year. Those panels really are quite clean in terms of uniformity. QD OLED, again, quite clean. Although the 55-inch S95C that I have here that I've been working with recently, in terms of just of a black uniformity, it's not as clean as last year's, and that's using the new panel as well. So, but it's nothing to worry about. Don't make a buying decision on anything like that, because you're never going to see it. You will if you shove a slide test pattern on, but you ain't going to see it with anything that's important. So yeah, don't worry about that. Right, so that seems to be questions. I seem to be doing a lot of talking at the minute, so we'll get this over quickly because there is a video. So if you want to get in depth with the new Panasonic 2023 range, I did interview Michael on video. I'll also give you my thoughts, having been hands-on with the TV, so I'm not going to repeat myself and do that again. It's an interesting lineup. The one issue that I think our members are going to have is the MZ1500, which is the second from Top TV. In the past, that's been the same panel as the flagship 2000 model, just without the speakers built in. Obviously, wasn't doing the numbers, wasn't selling as well as Panasonic wanted. So they also wanted a little bit more difference between the models in the model range. So the 1500 this year doesn't use the top end panel. So only the 2000 will have MLA this year. So if you want that panel, you want that Panasonic TV, you're going to have to buy it with the speakers that TV has built in, which is a full Atmos system with up-firing speakers and a soundbar and so on. That's the way it has to be with that model lineup. That's a decision that Panasonic have made. The MZ1500 has a soundbar underneath, a three-channel soundbar. Both TVs look very similar when you see them side by side in terms of design. But the 1500 only has the frontward firing speakers, not the side firing or the upward firing. So as an AV fan, you're probably a little bit disappointed in the fact that you're going to have to probably pay for something that you're not going to use. But if you go and buy the LG G3, you're up and you're not going to wall mount it, you're paying for quite an expensive wall mount that you're not going to use. So It swings around a bit. People, with, you have to make your choices and decide what you want. In terms of picture quality, absolutely outstanding, as you would expect from Panasonic. It's going to be very, very difficult if you're in the market for a high-end or flagship TV this year. I wouldn't want to be in your position, because one day I'll think, yeah, I think that's the best screen. And then the next day you watch it and you go, this one's a little bit better at doing this. And they've all got the pros and cons. You really just have to pick something that's going to suit your use case. So the video is up there. It's on our YouTube channel. It's also on AV forums. There's a news story on the homepage if you can't find it there. Go and watch that. Michael goes into some detail of the whole range. And nice to see a mini LED. I've been talking about mini LEDs. Panasonic have the 950, the MX950 coming this year. And I have specifically asked for that for review because I know there's quite a bit of interest on the forums. We haven't really seen a flagship LCD TV from Panasonic since the 902, which was probably getting on 5 or 6 years ago now. So, and that was a 3D TV, so that tells you just how long ago that was around. So nice to see Panasonic pushing out a higher end LCD TV, and I am getting that in for review as well. So I think that kind of wraps up everything at the moment. If you've got any questions, send them in. podcast@avforums.com or leave a comment in the thread on AV Forums. You'll find it at the bottom of the forum list, podcast forum. Go and find this episode, leave your question in there, and we'll come back to it. And before we wrap up on the TVs, I am going to go back and talk about some of the feedback that we've had from the last podcast, because they're all questions on TVs. So I'm going to get through these as quickly as I can, but hopefully also answer them for you. And most of them are based on my preview of the Panasonic event that I was going to go along to. So Nisiko, I think it is, 527 comments. We'd like to know if Panasonic goes all out with their mini LED. And from what I've read, it could very well be more than 1,000 dimming zones. No, it's not as much as that. There's not a lot of dimming zones in there. Exact numbers we'll be able to count when we get it in for review. Is it going to be good? It was promising. I spent some time with it. It does look very good. It's a nice design. It's a Panasonic picture. And if you've seen Panasonic TVs, you know what I'm talking about when I say it's a Panasonic picture. It does look very nice, natural, accurate. So really looking forward to getting that in for review. Joanna's Iones or Iomas 5781. Sorry if I'm pronouncing these all wrong. Which TV is better, the Panasonic MZ2000 or the Samsung S95C 77 inch? Well, the Panasonic 77 inch doesn't have MLA. That is exclusive to LG's lineup only this year. So only the 55 and 65 will have MLA. Panasonic 77 inch doesn't have MLA. So if that's important to you, that kind of pushes you in the direction of the Samsung, I guess. Both of them very, very good TVs. I haven't spent enough time with the MZ2000 yet, but I will obviously get that in for review as soon as it's available. But yeah, the 77 doesn't have MLA, so that maybe answers a question for you. Does the MZ2000 use the Pentonic 1000 chip? No, it doesn't. We cover that in the video, so if you want Panasonic's answer to that, it is in the video. Go watch the video. Will Panasonic bring the Google UI to the flagship TVs? That's from James Brettel 3765. Not that I'm aware of. They're going to stick with the My Home screen. That's certainly the case this year. All the flagships are My Home screen. It's when you drop down to the slightly lower end of their lineup, you've got Google, and you also have a Fire TV as the entry level entry point. So there's three smart systems this year, but the flagships are all My Home screen, and I've never found anything wrong with My Home screen. It's a nice, simple, smart system to use, and it's always worked when I've tested it. So yeah, it's quite a good system there. Paul Taylor 113, do Panasonic OLEDs have a problem with motion, specifically thinking about watching sports? I still have a Panasonic plasma, which of course has no problem with motion. No, they don't have any issues with motion. I've never had any issues. There is a slight micro stutter if you use the frame creation, intelligent frame creation. If you have that switched on in any way, there is a very slight micro stutter, but you're going to be pushed to see that. It's usually with anything that looks like clouds or so on. So I wouldn't worry about that at all. And then there was one last thing, which was for a point of clarity regarding the difference between dynamic tone mapping and Dolby Vision's dynamic metadata. Because there was a question on one of the reviews that said, why did you say static tone mapping is a good thing? When you bring up the fact that Samsung doesn't have Dolby Vision, which is a dynamic tone mapping system. No, it's not dynamic tone mapping. The difference is dynamic tone mapping is basically using histograms and other things to look at the image a few frames ahead and adjust the image to suit a algorithm that a manufacturer has come up with in terms of how they think something should be tone mapped. So it is not accurate and it's not doing it as the creator intended. Dolby Vision, on the other hand, uses what's called dynamic metadata. So this is information that's actually written into the content and can be on a frame by frame or a scene by scene basis, basically telling the TV what the black point should be, what the peak white point should be, and everything in between. So that's what dynamic metadata is. And that's as the creator intended, because the creator is telling the TV, basically, you should be displaying it this way, and the TV then displays it that way. That's the difference. Hopefully that clears up anything or any issues there. And it was Demon Returns 4336 that asked that one. So hopefully that clears it up for you. Dynamic tone mapping is something that the manufacturer is adding. It's a bit of processing that they're doing, sometimes either using the light meter in the TV. Dynamic metadata is supposed to be there. It's telling the TV exactly how the content should look. Right. I've been too much talking in this point now.
It's quite the monologue.
Yeah, we're going to wrap up on TVs for the minute. If you do have questions, keep them coming in. We will answer them. And Adrian from Scotland, hello there, said, I just wonder if the Sony A95L will support DTS. It should do, but we'll be able to confirm that once we get it through for review. So that's the TV section wrapped up. We're going to home cinema section next, and somebody else is going to do the talking.
Yay.
If you'd like to support the AV Forums podcast on a regular basis, then why not become a patron? Head over to patreon.com/AV Forums to sign up. You can also make a one-off donation through the Super Chat or via streamlabs.com/AV Forums. All donations help us to improve the website and the podcasts. Thank you to all our supporters.
So moving on to the home cinema section, we've got some reviews coming up in a minute from Doug. But first of all, Ian's going to take us through some news and I'm going to go and get some water.
Okay, yeah, a couple of similar sort of audio systems to talk about. First of all, Yamaha has announced a new, what it calls the TrueX sound system, which is effectively three component parts, which is a soundbar, SW-X100A subwoofer, and the... I've forgotten what the name of it is, but a speaker that goes with it as well. Things get a little bit more confusing because it lists two different soundbars, the SRX50A and the SRX40A, but the only difference seems to be that the former comes with the subwoofer in the box, so otherwise the soundbars are the same six-speaker configuration, incorporating racetrack drivers for the first time in a Yamaha soundbar, plus a couple of height channels to go with the Dolby Atmos support that comes with it. You can buy them as separates. So the subwoofer and soundbar combo will cost you £799, with the X40A soundbar on its own at £549. The subwoofer on its own you can get for £299, and the WS-X1A is what the speaker's called, and they cost you £149 a pop. All of those can work as standalone items, or you can bundle them together in one handy package called the TrueX system, which costs you £999, which obviously includes soundbar, the subwoofer, and two of those surround speakers for what would essentially be a 4.1.2 wireless surround setup. So it could be interesting to see here that how it performs when it launches, which is due to be in September.
Nice. I mean, it's I don't know. I don't need to choose my words carefully. I looked at this news story, and it's one of those things where it's fundamentally seems like quite a good idea and quite a neat product, and then there's just extra levels of, yeah, as you say, variations of how you buy it, which just seems to make it just that little bit more complicated. But, you know, that's Yamaha's going to Yamaha, I guess. So that's fine.
And we should be getting those in for review as well. So you can keep your eyes peeled for that. Anything else we need to know about?
Yeah, similar home audio system from Sony, which has announced what it's calling a portable theatre system called the HT-AX7. It's priced at 400 £499 to start shipping in the UK from the 4th of August. It's not hugely dissimilar to the Yamaha TrueX system, and then it comes with a main central unit rather than a soundbar. That front unit, essentially the front unit, comes with a couple of X-Balance speaker units. Then on top of that, you get a couple of wireless satellite speakers that you can either dock on the main unit for a single use, or you can take both of them off and move them around wherever you like around the house, either as standalone speakers or as a part of a larger surround system. Setup comes with Sony's 360 spatial sound mapping tech, plus an upmix algorithm, so it helps to create those multiple phantom speakers for the wider 3D sound stage, even from stereo sources. So with some careful placement of the three speakers around the room, Sony says you can fill any room with rich sound. And £499 in a wireless, what seems to be a fairly flexible package, sounds like it could be quite an interesting proposition.
Yeah, it sounds like you need to be rich to get that encompassing sound. No, it does sound really interesting. In all seriousness, they do this kind of thing very well, Sony. Their whole spatial 360 stuff is very, very interesting tech. And I've had a few demos, I've had a few of the systems to listen to, and it's impressive stuff. I mean, you know, you'll never replace the fact that there's not a speaker in any given position in the room, but with what it does do in terms of, the DSP that's applying it, in terms of the algorithm that's applying, psychoacoustic, everything else that's employed in there, it's very, very good, very interesting technology. So we are getting this in for review as well, so keep your eyes peeled. Well, that should be a few weeks for that one coming in. Just on a side note, Doug's also going to be taking a look at Sony's latest AVR, which has 360 spatial built in as well. So we'll have a bit more on that going forward. A little bit of gaming news, Ian.
Yeah, we've got a 26.5-inch OLED gaming monitor from AOC. It's got the very catchy title of the AG276QZD.
Perfect. It just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it's a catchy little name, you know. But it should do the job very, very nicely, because it is a very serious piece of kit for people who are equally serious about gaming, because it comes with a price tag of £879.
Bargasm.
So if you're looking in the Amazon Prime Day sales for a cheap OLED and see this for £879, it could be quite a tough call. But it does come, like I say, with some very good specs. It's a 2560 by 1440 QHD display, refresh rates up to 240 hertz, greater gray response times down to 0.3 milliseconds. You also get things like a low input lag mode, support for adaptive sync and G-Sync, a couple of speakers built in, you get the game modes, game styles to play with, plus, of course, the obligatory light show around the back, courtesy of a light effect setup. Serious piece of kit for serious gamers, but if you play a lot of online or multiplayer or competitive gaming, then, you know, I'm sure people will be able to get plenty of decent value out of it.
Or you simply want better skin tone on your online pornography. I mean, you know, let's be all encompassing on this. Just out of academic interest, I mean, is this, Phil, is that size coming from LG Display now, or is this from somewhere else? Or do we know?
You're asking me, and I don't know about the 26.5, because it's a quad HD. I don't think it's 4K. So
yeah, so it sounds like it's different again, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. It's 240 hertz as well. So I don't know is the immediate answer, but I can look it up. I do know it's TPV, so it's TP Vision that are handling this. So yeah, it does. It looks really interesting. Just a little bit pricey at the minute.
Cool.
Right then. I think we're done with the news, are we, Ian?
Yep.
Right, Doug, it's your time to shine.
Yeah, I think it's over to me now.
It is. And I've got to say, I am very, very jealous that you've not just had one per listen system in, but you've had both of them now.
I have.
Lucky thing.
I've got two reviews for you, starting with the per listen R series. So the R series is R for reference. It's the second tier range in Polisson's range. The top one being the S series, the signature series, which was the one I reviewed previously, and I reviewed the sort of top end floor standards and the system based around that. And for this review, I was reviewing the top end of the R series as well. So the system comprised the R7T floor standing towers, the R5C center, and the R4B stand mounts, which are very capable main channels in their own right, really, and they were being used as surrounds, and a pair of their R212 dual 12-inch push-pull subwoofers. So it was a beast of a system, and
that must have been fun to unbox.
It took some time to unbox. Fortunately, I had help unboxing it, but yeah, it took some time. Fortunately, they took the boxes away with them during the review, which is not always the case, and I'm glad of it, because
you see, I find that boxes mixed, would have a filled mixed my blessing, hands. Doug, because it means that I am completely beholden to the manufacturer to then take it off.
Oh, yes, I was, yes. But so. I wasn't too hot sore about having the system in my living room for an extended period of time. Obviously I tested the S series, and the big question really is going to be, do you get much more for your money with the S series? Let's not beat about the bush here. This is a very high-end system in its own right. The S series was north of 40 grand, I think, for the system I had on test, whereas this is 26,000. So it's not small beer we're talking about here. It's still a very, very high-end system.
I feel a lot better about submitting a £12,500 DAC for review in this time phase as well, actually. I'm still looking like the voice of reason and economy, so that's good.
So, I mean, there are some key technical differences between the S series and the R series. And the main one really is the S series uses fancier diaphragm materials for their speakers. So they have thin ply carbon diaphragm woofers, which are these checkered space age materials that they use on their woofers, and they use beryllium for their tweeters. Whereas, the R series uses a more sort of down to earth pulp formulation for their woofers and silk dome tweeters. And so in theory, the sort of differences that sort of higher end engineering in the S series should control resonances ever so slightly better and yield a slightly smoother overall frequency response, as well as increased power handling, which it does do. But in terms of translating into a smoother frequency response, I mean, have a look at the charts for the R series. They're in the review, and Polisson have them on their website. We're talking incredibly smooth speakers here, incredibly flat. So I'm not really convinced that the S series really gets you any significant audible difference, really, in terms of controlling resonances. In terms of the overall performance of the system, it was absolutely fantastic, absolutely superb. As I said, the big question is, how does it compare to the S series? And I don't think I could reliably say which is better without them both in front of me in the living room, testing them sort of back to back. From memory, with that caveat out the way, from memory, I would say maybe the S series had a slightly more refined mid-range, but and had a slightly more open sound. But I mean, really, I think they probably sound more or less identical to one another. The S series gets you higher power handling and slightly fancier cabinets, but in terms of sound quality, the R series gets you to the point where I suspect the differences are only going to become apparent under very close back-to-back scrutiny. And sort of beyond this price, I would say the sort of diminishing returns are going to kick in very, very aggressively. And so that sort of brings you to a point where I'd say the R series are just exceptionally competent speakers in their own right and really don't need to be compared to the S series, and really, the S series is for people who have money to burn or who are really, you know, not too fussed in paying a good amount, several thousands of pounds, for that sort of extra marginal bit of improvement. Mm. I really would say that the R series for almost everyone is just going to be the better buy.
Doug, there'll be lots of people out there who haven't been fortunate enough to hear these systems. So maybe for a little bit of context, and for people, What kind of sound are you talking about? What kind of sound characteristic does Perlistan give you?
So they, as I say, the frequency response is incredibly smooth. And what that sort of translates to is they just sound very natural. And, you know, one does recognize speakers that are sort of tonally neutral, they're quite obvious. Everything just sounds as it should. And you definitely get that with the Perlistan. The other thing that you get both with the S series and the R series is their fancy waveguide arrangement, which does an incredible job of controlling the directivity of the speaker, which is essentially the way sound propagates around the speaker's cabinet. And the effect of that is that the off-axis sound corresponds very closely to the on-axis sound. And what that achieves is when the sound then bounces off the walls and the ceiling, the rest of your room, and then sort of meets again with the on-axis sound at the listening position, is it creates a wider, a larger sound stage, because the reflected sound and the on-axis sound are timbrally consistent, so you get the sense of space. So you really get that with both the S series and the R series. You get this incredibly wide sound stage that just is incredibly natural and neutral sounding, and there are endless reserves of power. I didn't get anywhere near the R series limits, and less so the S series. I mean, my ears would most certainly give in before the speakers did. So you're cruising at reference levels for these. The subwoofers are worth a bit of a mention. As I said, they're a dual push-pull arrangement, which is similar. People will be familiar with that from M&K's design. They use the same design. And essentially what that arrangement does is one driver fires internally into the cabinet and the other fires externally, and they're wired out of phase with one another. And essentially what that does is it controls distortion. And so these are among the cleanest measuring subwoofers you'll find. You have that both in the S-Series subs and the R-Series subs. They are just incredibly clean subwoofers. You may find subwoofers that output more at this price point. I mean, you can certainly find subwoofers that output more at this price point, but you'll be hard-pressed to find cleaner subwoofers that measure with lower distortion. They really are sort of subwoofer engineering to the nth degree. Whether or not, and I said this in my review, whether or not that engineering translates to an audible benefit is something I'm slightly skeptical of. I think with subs and certainly the lower bass frequencies, your ear's ability to resolve distortion sort of falls off a cliff in lower bass. You can hear it much more readily at sort of the frequency range of voices, because your ear's naturally very attuned to that. But you can't hear distortion very readily at bass frequencies. So you're paying a lot of money. These are $5,500 each. So it's 11 grand's worth of subwoofer in the system. You're paying a lot of money for that extra engineering to reduce distortion, which I'm not confident you would actually be able to really hear.
But this is symptomatic. Let's say symptomatic is the wrong word, because that suggests it's a bad thing. It is an inevitable point of all high-end anything. This is not limited to audio. That essentially manufacturers and designers are compelled to produce engineering solutions that, you're absolutely right. The nature of what is likely to be perceived as a benefit under any of those circumstances is going to be very limited. I'm always reminded one of the very limited edition Porsche versions from a couple of years ago had titanium valve springs. And when one Porsche engineer got a bit drunk at a press do. He just acknowledged that it had absolutely no tangible benefit to the performance, reliability or integrity of the engine. It's simply that if you're spending that much money on a racing car for the road, you want it to have, you just want it to know that it's filled with top quality stuff. And I imagine this is, it's, you know, it's not going to be detrimental to the performance of the item. As you say, it then commands a significant price premium, but it just, it quietens down the mental sort of anguish of, I paid a lot of money for this box. Is it the best box I can possibly own?
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. And that's true of the subwoofers further up the Bilisten range, is they really are refined to the point where distortion is, no one does subwoofers as well in terms of lower distortion, as far as I'm aware. But as you're saying, you know, you're buying that. You're buying that knowledge that it's engineering refinement, rather than that it's going to translate into audible benefit. And that's why I said in the review, if you, they are fantastic subs and they do sound great, but they are also 11K for the pair. Mm. And if you're going to find a place to economize with the system, that's the play. You know, the speakers, you're going to struggle to get speakers that are engineered as well, in my view. I mean, for the price, they are impeccably well engineered speakers and they sound fantastic. I mean, yes, you'll find equivalent other sort of extremely well engineered speakers, but in the home theater market, I'm not confident you
will.
Yeah,
I think that's a really important distinction. Listening to what you're saying and looking at the review, there is engineering at work here, which is of specific and tangible benefit to
absolutely
the sort of work that you're doing. And I agree. I can't think of much else around the 8K point that's going to that demonstrates quite the same level of fastidious attention to detail.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that's really what they're going for with Bilisten. All right, they for example, Dan Romer, the designer, they're putting him front and center of their marketing. They're really making a big thing about the fact that this is engineering, this is a real craft that they're putting into these speakers, and it really does translate into superlative performance. So what I would say with the R series really is the speakers are where it's at, the performance is exceptional. I don't think you can buy better for the price, which is why I gave it a best in class badge, which is the second for Bilisten, and the S series was the best in class in that sort of slightly higher tier bracket of performance. Whether or not the subwoofers justify 11K for the pair is something I'm skeptical about.
But as Ed said, you know, if you want a GT3 RS and use it on the road and you can afford it, why not? You're getting that level.
You know, it's all it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Buy more subwoofers.
Yeah.
Have four instead of two. You get a better
absolutely
base response.
One in each corner is the way to do it. Absolutely. Right. So let's move from eye-watering prices down to something that most people listening to the podcast can afford, the new Marantz Cinema 60.
Yes, so it was the Marantz Cinema 60 DAB, and I quickly lost the reference to DAB additional to the Cinema 60 in the review because I didn't want to keep saying it. And this is fundamentally the Cinema 60 that is available widespread. The Cinema 60 without the DAB tuner is only available sort of to the custom install market. So it is, for £1,300, a 7.1 channel receiver, or it has two subwoofer outputs. So depending on which convention you follow, it could either be 7.1 channel or 7.2. But fundamentally, it's seven speaker channels with two subwoofer outputs. It has 100 watts per channel, two channels driven, which should be enough for most living room sized systems without too demanding speakers. As expected for sort of modern AVR at this sort of price point, it comes with both Dolby Atmos and DTS:X. What it lacks though, compared to AVRs further up the Marantz Cinema range, is it doesn't have IMAX enhanced and it doesn't have Auro 3D. Auro 3D
Both of which I think you can pass on.
Yes, exactly. I think Aura 3D has its fans. IMAX Enhanced, I'm not so convinced about, but Aura 3D for music, certainly. And there is a small
the app mixer is fantastic.
Yes,
Aura 3D app mixer is probably the best on the market.
I would agree, which is why I'm a little bit of a fan of Aura. Because for music, actually, it's one of the few app mixers that I actually quite like listening to music on. Because you can alter the Aura effect, so you can tone it right down, so it's only very subtle, and it is very competent. So as I said, 7.1, 7.2, which means that if you want ceiling speakers in your system, you are going to have to forego having surround backs. And the surround backs on the Cinema 60 are fully assignable. And Marantz actually provides you with a huge amount of flexibility with reassigning them. You could have them as front heights or front tops or Atmos modules. If you have upfiring speakers, you can have them as a second set of main speakers. Could use them for bi-amping your main speakers. You could use them for a zone two. There's really sort of a huge amount of flexibility in where you assign the surround back speakers. But I used them as front heights in the when I was testing it. There's a trade-off there because actually having surround backs does add a huge amount, I find, to the immersiveness on the sort of listener level speakers, and I wouldn't sort of ideally go without having surround backs, so you need to sort of choose which compromise you take. Do you go without surround backs and have the height level information in Atmos tracks and assign those to ceiling speakers, or do you have the more immersive listener level situation?
It's an interesting point that because it comes down to preference, but just, you know, looking at the way Atmos is used at the minute in terms of height, in terms of how a lot of things are mixed, I'd go with 7-channel horizontal plane.
Interesting.
If that was the choice, that's what I would go with. If I had the room behind me. If I didn't have the room behind me, then obviously you go height. But yeah, at this level of the market, that's the way personally I would probably go with that.
Yeah, and it really is a tough call. And I'm personally sort of on the fence, and I think I would go one way or the other depending on the movie. There are some movies where I would really want that extra height information. And the thing is, for most people, they're not going to just install a set of ceiling speakers in case they want to assign the ceiling speakers for that particular movie. I mean, in my system, you know, I'm kitted out for a large number of speakers, so I was able to switch if I wanted to. I mean, the way I set it up, though, was to just use them for height speakers. And actually, I probably would go with that for the majority of the test movies that I'm used to, because that added height level information expands the size of the front soundstage. That's the thing I find most valuable. You don't get a huge amount of overhead effects all the time in Atmos tracks, but you do get this larger front soundstage if you have the front heights active, which I really enjoy. Like maximizing the size of the front soundstage, you know, for me is like one of my main aims with my systems. So that's what I went with that. But as I say, there's plenty of flexibility on offer from Marantz. And this, the Cinema 60 also features the new slightly more polished user interface that I've seen on a relatively recent Denon review, which is a nice clean interface, and it's I think it's 1080, so they've upped the resolution, and it just feels a lot more polished. This has been a bugbear of mine for years. The one notable improvement that Marantz has with this is the remote is absolutely fantastic. I think it's the first AVR remote in a AVR I've reviewed where I haven't just panned the remote and whined about it, because usually it's an afterthought for AVRs, and usually they are sort of visibly cheap, often with horribly spongy buttons, and not a very sensible layout. Whereas with the Cinema 60, and in fact the entirety of the Cinema range, they've clearly thought about the remote, and it is elegant and it looks lovely, and it feels great in the hand. All the buttons are very sensibly laid out, all the key buttons are there, and it's backlit, so it does everything that a good AVR remote should do, really. And so well done, Rance, for finally recognizing that people who pay over £1,000 for an AVR actually want something nice in their hands to control it on a daily basis. So I was really pleased about that. In terms of room EQ, it's Audacy on the Cinema 60. If you go further up the Marantz range, you get access to Dirac, but you don't get that with the Cinema 60. It's Audacy or nothing. But you can buy the Audacy app, or Audacy phone app, for I think it's about £20, which gives you a bit more control over the target curve for room EQ. Slightly more sophisticated, but it's still a pain to use the touchscreen interface to try and control target curves. It's a bit of a nightmare. You do also get the option of Mult EQ X, the desktop app that Audacy has released, which is actually fairly sophisticated. I've had a play around with it, but I didn't actually use it with the Cinema 60, because you need a license, and the license only operates on a per receiver basis. So if you did buy the license for Multi-Q X and you used it on your Cinema 60, and then you then sold your Cinema 60, well, the license goes with it. If you replace it with a new Marantz AVR, you need to buy a new license, and that's a bit of a pain, really, because it's about £160 for the software. But it does provide access to calibration options that's much more sophisticated than standard Audacy, and really is approaching direct levels of sophistication, but I question the sort of value proposition when you're spending sort of 10% of more than 10% of the cost of the AVR on something that is pegged to the AVR. The other thing worth noting is you really are limited to 7.1 channels. You can't add power amps and then get additional channels as you can further up the range, where the number of channels that the AVR processes is greater than the number that it internally powers. That's not the case with the Cinema 60. It only processes exactly the same number that it powers. So the only advantage of including wiring it to power amps is just additional power, really. You're not getting any further channel processing. So the big question: how does it sound? Absolutely superb, just like I've come to expect from Marantz. I have owned 4 different Marantz AVRs or processors over the years, and I'm a big fan. I think they do an excellent job of marrying comprehensive feature sets, rock solid reliability, and genuinely excellent sound quality. They're known, obviously, as being particularly musical receivers compared with their stablemate Denon. And I could see there's potentially some truth there. In my experience with Denon, AVRs tend to have a slightly more forward, almost slightly aggressive sound to them compared to Marantz, which have a slightly more laid back, warmer sound. And I think Marantz's AVRs are actually deliberately tuned for that. I think they have a slight bit of roll off in the high end, and they're tuned to give a slightly warmer sound than Denon. And it is actually audible, it is apparent. And I like it. I think it's great. So I tend to favour Marantz over Denham myself, but I've had both and I love both. I think they're fantastically competent products, and the Cinema 60 is just the latest in that.
Excellent. Good stuff. So it got a recommended badge.
Yep.
The review is up. It has been up for a few weeks. So if you want to get stuck into that a little bit more and find out a little bit more about it, then Doug's review is up there. Doug, thank you very much for your reviews. Right, so we are moving on next. And the next person to speak for half an hour is Ed.
If you enjoy the podcast on YouTube, then please like and subscribe. If you're listening to the audio version, then please leave us a rating on your podcast app. We invite you to email questions and feedback to podcast@avforums.com and join in with this episode's discussion thread in the podcasts forum at AV Forums.
Sorry, there we go. Professional to the end, I'd muted that because I was making noises. Right, hello everyone. It's the hi-fi section of this, which... I don't think we've got a full half hour, if I'm honest. We'll see how we go. There are some news stories to kick off with, and it's anniversary season. Now, we're going to be talking about anniversaries in a bit because it's all going a bit crazy out there. But we've got two anniversaries in the news story, and the first one in is for products that are they're at the sort of the spendy end of things.
Yes, yeah, very much falling under our what is now becoming almost a bi-weekly edition of speakers that cost more than a car. Bowers & Wilkins is the latest in the production line. They've launched two new signature versions from its 800 series Diamond range. The two models getting the signature treatment are the floor-standing 801 D4 speakers and the 805 D4 stand-mount speakers. The upgrades, all the details obviously up on the website if you want to get a deeper fill. But you're getting the likes of an enhanced aluminium top plate with a refined design aimed at delivering improved mid-range transparency. Also get Newport outputs to help clean up the base. And the signature models also come with two new finishes with a rather eye-catching midnight blue and a rather more wooden-looking California Burl gloss veneer.
The midnight blue is sensational. Yeah. I was lucky enough to be at Bowers & Wilkins when these were on the production line. I was sworn to secrecy. I wasn't allowed to talk about them. But they are absolutely gorgeous. They really are.
It must be said the wood has divided some of the comments online. You either love it or you think it looks like the dashboard of a 90s Nissan. We'll see what it is. I mean, I will say I'm quite excited by these. I do intend to look at the 805 signature, which would be, I think I'm right in saying, the most expensive stereo speaker we've ever tested for AV Forums. But we've tested the 805, the normal one. And so I think there is an interest in seeing how much better it is. There was also the minor detail that the 705 signature, now departed, scored a perfect 10. And this is the only Bowers & Wilkins speaker I've ever tested that has done that. So I think that there is an interest to seeing how good these are. The 801, I mean, Phil spent some time with the 801 as well. I have. They're just preposterously good. I mean, I sort of find myself wondering quite how much more they can wring out of that basic design. But there is an audience for these things. There's a target market for these things. And in some regards, I think some people will just go for it for the finish alone. As you say, the blue is a very, very smart thing.
Absolutely.
And so long as you've got decor that matches, or indeed, I suppose, if you've got a pair of £30,000 speakers, you can, you know, choose the decor to match the speakers. You can do this either way round. But yes, with good luck and a following wind, we do intend to look at the 805 signature, so we'll see how we get on there. Now, for people who are feeling less plutocratic, Ian, there's another anniversary, and this one's 70 years.
Yes, yeah, the birthday boys on this occasion are Harman Kardon, who announcing things rather more in my price range, with three new Bluetooth speakers on the way, with a original 15th September launch date. The most eye-catching of the three is probably the Aura Studio 4. It comes with a transparent cabinet housing, which got about 324 crystals inside, which glow in a range of different colours, presumably in sync with the music. And they also come with a rather less visible inside. You get a 132mm downfiring bass unit and a 6-drive speaker array inside. Also, there's a new Go Plus Play model on the way with a new Play 3 featuring a similar downfiring bass.
I've got to say... I've got to say, the Play 3, it looks like a handbag. It really does.
It gives it a portable edge, but I don't know whether you have to kind of walk a swagger when you move it around the house. I don't know. And yeah, just to wrap up the bunch, there's also a new two-way Luna speaker. Pricing still to be TBC at this stage, but we've got ballpark European pricing, €329 roughly for the Aura, €349 for the Play 3, and €179 for the Luna. But as mentioned, all to be confirmed and due on the 15th of September.
It's worth saying Harm Kardon is very, very good at these things. So I do imagine these are going to be very good products. I'd also like to, thank Simon Lucas, who is contributing to AB Forums, for heroically going out to the Montreux Jazz Festival to report.
Yeah,
you
did. That was hard work for Simon.
Backbreaking. On a more serious note, I'd also actually like to thank, you noticed it's been a bit of an odd one chronologically, because Simon has done a big chunk of Chord Electronic reviews for us. And they've all come through in a big lump, and it looks a bit weird. The reason for that, and just to reiterate, I can't review Core Electronic products. I do, I work with them on a professional level, and it's a conflict of interest that I have no desire to get anywhere near if I were to review those products. So Simon has very kindly moved through those items. We'll now look at any forthcoming Core Electronics products in a more sort of orderly fashion. But those were some important ones that had essentially come out in the significant amount of time since I'd last reviewed anything. So he has very kindly stepped up to the plate and he's got all those through. So that's why that went like it is. And that's why all henceforth Core Electronic reviews, at least in the current situation, will not be done by me. So that's why that happened. And thank you for Simon for doing that. Right. With that tedious admin out of the way, I'm feeling really smug about this because, you know, Doug's been there with his £25,000 worth of speakers and stuff. And the product that I just want to talk about, and there won't be too much to put up for anyone watching the video live or afterwards, because I'm in the process of writing the review because the amp didn't show up until last week. But AV Forums has the UK exclusive on the Mission 778X integrated amplifier. And this is, I'm not going to give away too much because I'd like you to read the review, and I feel I do my better work at typing rather than speaking. Nevertheless, I just want to flag ahead of time that this is a bit good. Mission is not synonymous with electronics for a lot of people. They're a loudspeaker manufacturer, but in the past they did make electronics, and weirdly they made a tone arm as well for a record player. I don't think they're going to be revisiting that. The 778 is £550. It sits sort of below the Audiolab 6000 series. Insofar as it's smaller, it doesn't have quite as much power, but it arguably has a better selection of connections than the Audiolab does. And in the last few years, I've reviewed the Riga IO, which was one of our products of the year, and the Project Meyer S3. I can't remember how many versions of Meyer we've had. Those are some of my favorite affordable integrated amplifiers. And if you wanted to be critical of both of those designs, the Riga is, to my mind, sufficiently powerful, has an excellent phono stage, and it's beautifully built, but there's no digital input. So if you want to add a digital any digital sort of capability, you'll need to add an external source for that. The Meyer, the project, has got inputs coming out of every orifice. It's got sensational connectivity for an affordable integrated amplifier. But as I was told in no uncertain terms by two people in the comments when I reviewed it, 23 watts is not enough. I query that for domestic listening, but nevertheless, 23 watts is not enough. So the Mission is fractionally more expensive than either of these products, but I would argue it combines the best attributes of the Riga and the Project. It's got connectivity, which is absurd for an amplifier at this price. Multiple digital inputs, including a really good USB connection, Bluetooth, analog inputs, and a really good phono stage. And then, just to add, to be the final sort of, momentarily important thing, it sounds extremely good. I've been having a whale of a time with it. I've got some really expensive things in the house at the moment, and you might think that not listening to those really expensive things and spending time listening to a £550 amplifier would be somehow tedious. It's not. I'm having a whale of a time with this product. I've been testing all of its bells and whistles, ready to get the review up, and We are homing in on awards season, as I am acutely aware, and we've looked at some strong contenders in various categories, and there's always what's going to end up with product of the year. Now, I don't know if it will be the mission. We have looked at some absolutely blinding things. There's another product in this tranche of reviews that have gone up, which I'll talk about in a future podcast, which has just garnered a best in class award because I can't honestly fault it. But nevertheless, for £550, this is an absolutely outstanding product. The only thing that I know is going to raise comment is I think some people are going to be not as keen on the looks as I am. Mission has done a neat job. IAG/Mission has done a neat job of revisiting the Mission/Cyrus 1 amp of the 1980s. And I think it's great. This is because I own lots and lots of retro trainers, retro watches, and I'm fundamentally a man born out of time. I think a number of you are going to be a bit disappointed. I think that the looks are perhaps a matter of personal taste, and we'll see how we go on that. But otherwise, there's almost nothing I can say that's going to be sort of a negative for this product. It's exceptionally impressive, and it could be the all things to all people affordable amplifier that we've been looking for. So yes, the review, I will be finishing the review tomorrow. Hopefully I'll have enough time to then slap it onto the site. It then needs to be read and checked by an adult, just so you, in case you're wondering how this progress goes. Andy, who does lots of work for us in the background, will email me going, did you mean this? And we know that would be me doing a stupid typo or things like that, or no, there's a complete sentence missing there or things like that. And he does, he makes it less dreadful. And then hopefully we'll get it up, because as I say, it's the first UK review, it really hasn't put a foot wrong. So yeah, we've got that to look forward to. Now, Phil, I'm loose on the protocol here. Right. Should I do recommendations first?
I'll tell you what, let's do your album vinyl and playlist, and then we'll come back to what's going on with all these anniversary products.
Yeah, very well. Right, okay, this shouldn't take too long. Album of this podcast cycle is a group called Nothing But Thieves. Their fourth album, Dead Club City, came out not last Friday, Friday before. Nothing But Thieves are an acquired taste. A friend of mine describes them as disco muse. And whilst I think that's a little childish, it's not entirely unfair. Some of this is a bit like disco muse. I've really enjoyed this album. I don't think they take themselves that seriously. And it's got some really, really, really good tunes on it. I've been listening to it a lot. It is on all the major streaming services in a variety of resolutions. You can buy it on compact disc LP, which is popped up on the side of the podcast. And I'm sure that somewhere there'll probably be a limited edition cassette or something like that, because there generally is for these things these days. I've really, really enjoyed it. It doesn't go on too long. It has a bit of a lull, but there's enough really, really good tunes that I think it's well worth a listen, well worth about 35 minutes of your time. Now, vinyl, I actually changed this halfway through today. This is a group called Penguin Cafe. Now, people here with long memories may remember that there was another group called Penguin Cafe Orchestra, who released some of the most interesting sort of modern chamber music of the late 70s, mid 80s. Tragically, the man who founded the band died. He died very young. His son has now set up Penguin Cafe, and it's not just the same as Penguin Cafe Orchestra. It is, I would say, more orchestral in its basis. It's less whimsical. It works on a slightly larger scale. This album, Rain Before Seven, came out on Friday. If you are a Qobuz, and I believe Amazon and Apple Music user, this is available in extremely high resolution. And it's on all the other streaming services. And if you want to buy it on CD, you can. I've got another Penguin Cafe album on vinyl, and it's sensational. It's a beautiful piece of music, and the people that put it onto a record knew what they were doing and put a lot of effort in. I haven't got this yet. It has been ordered. It hasn't arrived. But I'm pretty confident that this is going to be a spellbinding piece of analog. If you're not interested in analog, good for you. As I say, you can enjoy it on digital as well. I think it is exceptionally beautiful music. if you're fans of things like cinematic orchestra and bands like that, there's a lot to like here. It feels vaguely cinematic in what it does, and I've been listening to it a couple of times, and I thought, actually, do you know what? This is better than the other vinyl recommendation I was going to make. So that is my choice for vinyl release of the podcast. And then, because all of this has been in a bit good taste, the playlist recommendation is on Cobuzz. And I'm following on from sort of theme from last time. Cobuzz has put 80s summer hits up as a playlist. And I mean, would you be surprised to learn that it basically does exactly what it says on the tin? You know, if the weather perks up and it stops, you know, peeing down with rain, this is ideal for the task. Get stuck into that. Andy very kindly now puts the link to the podcast in the link to these things into the podcast running order comments thread. So remember, if you are not a Cobuzz subscriber, I could ask why, but that's fair enough. But you can use a website called Soundiz, so that's sound and then double IZ, and you can take the URL link from Cobuzz and port it to the streaming service that you do use, and you can enjoy it in that. And I would suggest that you do enjoy it. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's it doesn't rewrite any major rules, but it's a lot of fun. So okay. Yeah.
Excellent recommendations. The 80s one is right up my street, so that'll be on in the background tomorrow while I'm writing. So what is with all these anniversary products, Ed? Yeah. Why are we suddenly seeing them all?
Well, this is a talking point. I don't want to spend much more than a couple of minutes on this, because it's something I actually want feedback on, because my views on this, I don't believe necessarily gel with you know, people who are buying these things or might not be buying these things. As you've just noticed, Marantz is in its 70th anniversary. Harman Kardon's in its 70th anniversary. We've got commemorative products coming out right, left and centre. In the clutch of reviews I've just put up is a 50th anniversary Rager Planer. We've just had a new story that Johnny Ive has got his designy hands on the Lin LP12 and done a £50,000 limited edition 50th anniversary version of that. I think it's really important. I don't have a, you know, I'm delighted that we've had these companies around for so long. It's important to stress, for every company that makes it to a milestone like this, dozens fall by the wayside and do not. So people who work for these companies should be delighted that they've made it this far. My concern, and it's something I just want to ask really, a lot of these products look backwards rather than forwards. And I think that's fair, because you do want to celebrate what you've been doing and, you know, your heritage and your legacy and things like that. It just feels a little bit overcautious. And is that actually what people, I mean, if you're thinking of buying a hi-fi product, if you're, for example, thinking of buying an amplifier in summer 2023, do you want, you know, some of the products that we've looked at more recently, or do you want a name Nate anniversary, which is basically an absolutely, you know, down to the bolt. Well, it's not a perfect replica, for it's actually meant to sound better. I haven't heard one. A perfect replica of an amplifier that they were building in the 1970s. I mean, then there's degrees of that. We did the NAD 3050 limited edition. That's very, very modern on the inside. It is certainly not very, very modern on the outside. And it just feels, I don't necessarily know how many of these products are looking forward to the next 50 years, or people going, right, we've made it 50 years, let's see what happens from here.
I think, Ed, there's two distinct camps here. I think there is the retro craze that's currently going on.
Oh, for sure.
Where, you know, people of our generation now with disposable incomes are suddenly thinking, I wanted that when I was younger and I couldn't afford it. I'm going to go and buy one. Or, look, there's this 50th anniversary edition and I wanted one of them when I was a kid. I couldn't afford it. I'm going to go and get one. There's that side. And then there's the side, probably where I fall in, I think, where you want to celebrate a product that was groundbreaking at the time. My go-to is always the Technics SL1210 Mark. That was my turntable. I spent weekends and weekends and weekends using them in a professional capacity, and I absolutely adore them. you can't get a decent one now because they were all used in clubs and pubs and light cases, and getting one that's immaculate is impossible. So Technic's releasing a 50th anniversary where I could get it in a colour that was a little bit unusual, and they were actually limited in terms of numbers that came into the country. I'm going to lap that type of product up, and I think that's your two camps, I think, at the minute when it comes to these types of products. I may be wrong though, but from my point of view, that's, and I definitely lean into the, there are things, Nike re-released their Windbreaker jacket from the 80s. I don't know if you remember it.
Yeah.
I always wanted one, could never afford one. I saw one in the Nike shop. I bought it because I can afford it now. Yeah. You know, I've got that, and I've got that nostalgia. So yeah, I think there's two camps.
Well, I mean, I think there's different, I mean, thinking back to the AV receiver that Doug has been talking about, the Marantz, I think that their retro tinging of their style, I think that's been done exquisitely well. I think that's a modern looking product that gives some nice nods to the past. And it's also, you know, the specification, as Doug covered, it's bang up to date. It's just making some little tips of the hat back to the past point. And then equally, I've got the Riga playing the 50th anniversary. As I say, that's gone into the upcoming reviews. Riga done a very Riga thing for their anniversary product. You get more specification for less money. And that's, I think that that's, you know, that's, if you like, that's the essence of what they've been doing for 50 years. So that's a very neat way of doing things. And obviously they still do good business out of turntables. So that's also going to be important as well. I think it's an unfortunate coincidence that so many companies have an anniversary ending with a zero rather in 2023, but we might be approaching sort of overload on this. And I'm just interested to hear people's thoughts. I think Phil's on the money. I mean, I buy things where it's like, oh, that is quite cool, and I didn't buy it because I was either a child or I couldn't afford it. But I think it's getting a bit relentless, and I think it may be possibly time for people to start thinking about what their next 50 years is going to look like, rather than simply mining the past of what they've already achieved.
You have any thoughts on this, Doug? Because you've been buying these things as a consumer for many years like us. So,
yeah. So I probably agree with you, Phil. I think really anniversary products are great when they really hark back to something special from yesteryear that you didn't have the money to afford at the time, where you really lusted after, and it just iterates on it a little bit and improves it here and there. But fundamentally, it's the same sort of industrial design, and you feel like you've got the thing that you really wanted or you really enjoyed many years ago. The other approach to take, the one that comes to mind, is the Denon AVC A110 from 3 years ago, when Denon was celebrating its 110th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Is when you release a product and it's just all bells and whistles. It harks back ever so slightly to a product from like several generations before, in this case, the AVC A1, which was a sort of legendary Denon AVR, and it sort of echoes the styling, but it really throws everything at it, and it gives you the top spec machine at the time. And I think that's probably my favorite approach to celebrating an anniversary, is where something is sort of harking back. It has the industrial design that harks back, but it's giving you blistering
Go balls out, basically.
And it's really that's a great way to celebrate an anniversary, I think.
I think that's very fair.
You got any input here?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously I come from a gaming background where obviously anniversaries aren't quite that long. It's not really 70-year-old video game. But yeah, I mean, my comparison is more from, you know, the limited editions, the special edition versions that you get for video games. I mean, you look behind me, I've got like statues and models and all sorts of bits and pieces that come with the limited edition versions of the game. I'm looking at Starfield coming out in September, and I'm kind of partly thinking about spending £250 on it, because there's a version that comes with the watch you get to wear in the game with all the various bells and whistles that come with it. So I think when it comes to anniversary products or those specials, what I'm looking for is something that's a little bit unique. I think Phil mentioned it earlier about, you know, maybe they come with a look, this, you know, you're not going to get on the other products. Something a little bit different that, you know, there's only going to be 500 of them. So you could have something that maybe you can sit in your room, someone's going to come around and you can say, oh, look, I've got this. Nobody else has, or, you know, very few other people have got something like this. It's like a, I mean, obviously it's a little bit different when you're spending thousands and thousands of pounds on some of these things. But, you know, if it's some of the cheap, more affordable stuff, then yeah, I'd probably be tempted to go for something that was a little bit unique, even if it wasn't, you know, the latest, greatest tech. If it was something that I could feel was, you know, personal to me, unique to me, and just had something a little bit different about it, then I'd be tempted, as I clearly have been several times in the past when it comes to buying video stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I'm sure lots of our listeners and viewers out there have their own opinions on this. So if you do have your thoughts, then you can add them to the chat, although the chat's only going to be open for another couple of minutes because we're about to wrap up. But yeah, get your comments in, use the thread on AV Forums, go to the main forum list, go down to the bottom of the page, you'll find the podcast forum, go in there, find this episode, and leave us your comments and your thoughts on retro or anniversary. What does it mean to you? You know, will you, like myself and Doug, go out and buy an anniversary product because it reminds you of something that you lusted after but could never get your hands on, that kind of thing. And there's companies out there who are still doing that type of thing. Dragon, Nakamichi. It exploded at CES because that name came back, and that's a name that goes back in terms of hi-fi decades. And it was all about good engineering back then as well. And it's something that's sorely missed these days, I think, is that quality of mechanisms and engineering and all that kind of thing. So that really appeals to people. But anyway, give us your thoughts on the chat. Just quickly going through chat, I don't think there's anything that we've missed out. Other than Adrian from Scotland said, I've done calibrated mode on my S95B. Any clue how to delete this from the TV? I'm assuming that you've messed around with it and you want to reset it. So if you go into the picture menu, go into that picture preset, down the bottom, there's usually a reset button. If you don't have a reset button, you can factory reset and it will do that for you as well. I don't know exactly what you mean by that, but I'm assuming that that's what you mean. Now, I think we've answered all the other questions. Oh, Michael L. said he currently has a GZ 1565-inch. He loves it. Picture quality is fantastic. Which of these TVs would be substantial upgrade, if any? And you're talking about the Panasonic TVs. The MLA 2000 model is definitely a big step up. Is it worth trading in your 1500? I can't answer that one for you. You'll have to answer that one yourself. But go have a look at 2000 if you can. The MZ 2000 is a spectacular TV, so go and see when they are released. I think that's us all up to date on that as well. So yeah, all I need to do now is tell you about the next podcasts coming up from AV Forum. So the next podcast is the movies edition. It'll be along on the 17th of July. That starts at 8:30 if you want to watch it live with Kaz and the guys on our main channel here, or you can listen in any point after that recording and listen to that later in the week. This podcast, AV Forums Podcast, we will be back in 2 weeks' time on the 24th of July, and that starts at the usual time of 7 p.m. if you want to join us live. And of course, it's available after that as well on all other streaming services and YouTube and everywhere else that you find your podcast. All I need to do now is thank Ed, Ian and Doug. Thank you very much, guys, for your time this evening. It's appreciated.
No worries.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, then of course give it a like, subscribe to the channel, do all the usual social things that everybody talks about. And of course, if you're following us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, that's great. There's a new one out there called Thread. We might even turn up on there at some point. We don't know. It seems to be that Twitter's just a bit odd at the moment, so we'll see what happens with that one.
Being owned by a lunatic will do it for you.
Allegedly. Plus, why not leave us a 5-star rating on any of the podcast services that you use if you've enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you for the next one. Good night.